the banana traders. People don't think about it, but the biggest is Chiquita, you know. They're like the biggest traders. These guys, they own the market of bananas in the world. Like, people don't realize that in crude oil, there's a lot of players, a lot of big money, and a lot of big transactions. So it's very, you know, these are the guys where you see they're trading all day, every day, 24/7. And now the newcomer is Dubai. And I believe that Dubai is the new Geneva.
Welcome to a new podcast episode. I'm your host, Paul Uyoli. In each episode, we bring you exclusive interviews with experts in shipping, offshore, energy, and commodities, sharing all the knowledge you need to succeed in these industries.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to a new podcast episode. Today, we are joined by Tobias Nolli. He's a commodity trader. It's a pleasure to having you.
Likewise. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you. Can you introduce yourself, please?
So I'm Tobias. I'm 30 years old. Today, I'm a trader in fertilizers, and I've been in the industry for about 10 years. About so.
Okay. It's quite interesting. Today, we're going to talk about commodities trading.
Yeah.
Of course, you have so many commodities. I'm going to ask you different specialties. But first of all, can you introduce what is your position, fertilizer trader?
So, fertilizer trader. So usually I'm the head of European and African markets in my job, located in Geneva. I'm not going to go into all the commodities I handle, but the fertilizers in general, nitrogen based, I will say no liquids. That's as easy as I can say, because there is about, I don't know, maybe 50 to 60 different commodities in fertilizers.
Okay. Oh.
So that's a little bit more, man.
Okay. Wow. Why did you specialize in fertilizer?
So wasn't really a choice in the beginning. So when I started my career, you know, I had an opportunity in fertilizers. I came from the petrochemical side and crude at Saudi Aramco, and then moved on to another company, which was in fertilizers. And then I just started to be good in that industry and logically, you know, gain some knowledge and then continued into this. And it's very niche. So in a certain way, you know, not a lot of people in this industry. So then I specialized and moved on from operator to trader to manager trader.
I think it was very good to come back about why you many people start as an operator. But first, what is a commodities trader? What are you doing exactly? What is your added value?
So for me, I'm only on the physical side. So I'm only going to speak about what I know. But as a commodity trader, obviously you have suppliers and customers. As a trader, your value is first and foremost shipping, you know, bringing goods from a point A to a point B. Second of all is having a structure that can finance very big deals. Meaning, I don't think a farmer or a distributor can buy 30 million in US dollars of urea, for example. That's why you take that risk, you take that position, you bring it from point A to point B, you get it financed, and then you distribute to the different people that will use it. And obviously, there is as well the economical side, you know, taking a position, bringing it, the risk, etc. That's the added value of a trader.
Okay. Maybe you can compare, we have physics trader, I mean, forex trader, the paper trader.
Exactly.
What is the difference?
So physical is really the guys that will, I'll take it as easy as possible, but handling the physical stuff, you know, you're, as I said, you're bringing it from point A to point B. The paper traders are people more on the economical side. They will take a position on a price, meaning they will, whether it's future options or swaps. And fertilizers will only really do swaps, but we will, you know, take a position on the price in the future. So it's more someone who's analytical, not saying that the physical guys aren't. I'm the freight, you know, is only on the shipping side, I would say.
Okay. See. So in your case, in the physical side, what kind of tasks do you have in the daily basis?
Oh, so maybe I'm going to disappoint a lot of people, but I would say 90% of my time, I'm sitting on my phone, whether it's chatting with people or speaking on the phone. That is 90%, you know, trying to scatter the market and see what's the situation. Second is reading reports, you know, what's the prices today, what's happening, what's the deals, etc. And getting a global view. And that is handling the deals, you know, bringing stuff from point A to point B and trying to find new customers, new flows, seeing what the market is. Understanding the global situation, whether it is linked to fertilizers or not, you know, everything has a geopolitical side.
Yeah.
For example, now we have the elections in the US. We have to know what's going to happen. You know, Trump is fundamentally different towards the sanctions for Russia. So, you know, this is something that will really influence our market. So we have to be, you know, really committed to understand what's going to happen.
Okay. So economics, I mean, you need to understand the macroeconomics.
Exactly. You have to be more, I would say, you know, you have to understand the whole market, you know, have a global view of what could happen, you know, every single event in the world, whether it's an election, unfortunately, a war as well, or, you know, for now in Europe, Southern Europe hasn't seen a lot of rain. For me, it's really impacting fertilizers because they're used according to what weather it is or season or whatever. So, you know, all these things has to be into consideration.
Okay, interesting. Okay. So you are responsible of moving the freight of your company. Are like trader owner of the freight or you are just an intermediate?
So it depends. It depends on what time of trade. So how we do it, we're always the owner of the goods, always. So I would say I do like 99% of all traders, we buy FOB, we sell CFR, a little bit more sometimes, but we always own the goods. We have another strong point. We own the vessels as well.
Yeah.
So that's another strong point that I have. So we really own almost everything during the transaction. You could do it differently. For example, the paper guys are doing it a bit differently. They never own it.
Okay.
But for us, we do it.
Okay, interesting. On if on the storage of the goods, yeah. Are you managing as well the...
Yeah, exactly. I forgot to mention it before. Yes, it's not always depends on which flows, but usually we have a bit of storage depending on, you know, which region. In Europe, not that much in my condition, but we're very strong in Asia. In Asia, we're storing a lot. We have our own plants, we're producers as well. So we're handling as well the production side, storage side.
Okay. And what is your vision as a commodity trader? What is the goal? What can you say I'm a good trader?
Look, a good trader is on the, I would say the only metric that could tell who's a good trader is who has a good P&L. I mean, it's a money-driven industry. That is the number one. Maybe people don't want to hear it, but, you know, a trader is here for the money first and foremost. Then it is because you have an interest and you're good in it. But a good trader is the one who can see an opportunity, bring it, and make money 51% of the time.
Okay.
No, that, okay. 51% and above, you're a good trader. Under it, you're a bad trader.
Okay, interesting. In terms of tasks, I mean,
yeah.
You need to negotiate, to forward the goods to,
yeah.
to another country at the lowest price. That is our mission.
Yeah, correct. So this is another thing that people don't understand, you know, where they think that traders, you know, are useless, which is not the case. There are almost, you know, you need traders in the world. We are able to secure such low prices that we are actually driving down the prices in country. People think it's the opposite, but usually it's not. You know, we have such a buying power, you know, when we go see a supplier and we buy, I would say, 1 million tons a year, you know,
yeah.
We have another discussion that someone that would be maybe buying 50,000 tons a year. So we're bringing down the prices exactly. And that's really where you need traders. We're bringing down prices and making it affordable. Even if people don't see it this way, but this is the job of a trader, you know, in the end of the day, you will get your deal because you had the lowest price.
I can understand. And with who are you working? I mean, in the fuel process, as a junior ship broker, I know that we are between you and the ship owner.
Yeah.
Few ship by the sea. Are you working with ship brokers as well? With
yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm even working with your company, but I'm not going to mention with who I'm working. But of course, yes, we have our own vessels, but obviously, you know, it's a limited amount and mostly they're in Asia and Africa, in Europe, you know, where it's a lot of coasters and smaller vessels. I'm using brokers. I mean, ideally where I've worked in the past, people were more exclusive to one broker. So maybe it's not even a broker. It's maybe a subsidiary of their shipping department, but yes.
Okay.
It's very important, I think, to have a good ship broker. For my vision, it's good to work with a lot of people, you know. Sometimes people will have a good opportunity and some not.
Understanding. I noticed in commodities company, most of the time you have like the commodities trader. You have the chartering desk as well.
Yeah.
What is the difference between both?
So, look, the chartering guys, they will only secure a freight, a voyage.
Okay.
You know, that is their mission, getting the cheapest freight possible. And making sure everything runs smoothly, you know, from the charter party and making sure all the contracts are in good hand according to the shipping. Trading guys is a bit different. I think as a good trader, you need to understand chartering, or at least you need to come from that background. The very good traders, I believe, this is only my own opinion, but they come from this background. They understand the importance of chartering. So it is linked, you know, but we do very different stuff.
Okay. Interesting. And are you like securing your position of, the rate of the commodities, or it's only paper trading? I mean, as a physical trader?
Yeah.
Are you buying at a certain price and then you sell it, or?
So it depends. Yes, on the physical. Look, in fertilizers, it's way different than all the bigger, because we don't have a market or an index, you know, of the prices. That's why we cannot hedge our commodity. So we do it the old school way. Very weird in fertilizers. So yes, there is paper trade. That's not really how we do it. For example, you know, I will more take into consideration geopolitical side, big tenders coming up to secure pricing, whether I go long or if I go short. That will depend as well on season and how I see the market.
Okay. You mentioned before about operations.
Yes.
Why do we need to start an operation, or what is operations?
So look, operation is a bit controversial. And I have met people that are saying that a good trader is not a good operator, and a good operator is not a good trader. And I've seen companies that have said, you know, if you need to be a trader, you need to be in ops, you need to be in chartering, you know, you need to understand the full flow. So best way to put it, an operator is the guy who puts everything into movement from the trader. The trader says, we buy here, we sell here with this price at this timing. Make sure everything runs smoothly, you know. So you're the guy who's going to handle, you're going to draft the contracts. You will get Taylor. Depends on your task, but, you know, maybe do the financing, the invoicing, the import formalities, the release of the documents, you know, and you're the little bit, you know, you're handling all the departments. You're making sure, you know, legal was okay with the contract. You get the contract, you send it to the different counterparties. Huge taking with chartering, making sure, you know, you're respecting, you know, when you should send the goods, that everything is going smoothly, charter party as well.
Okay.
You go see the finance guys, make sure, you know, the deal is financed, everything is okay. Then you go see compliance. And this is a bit your job, you know, you're the guy handling everything.
Okay, so in shipping, as well, we have the operation, ship owners have operation, and charter have operation, there's the one. Do you think it's useful and very important to start in operations before, like, switching to commodity trading?
It's a good question. As I told you, you know, there's two different teams, obviously, in this industry. I think it's important. It's good to understand, because you're seeing all the departments, and, you know, it's good at least to see where you want to go and where you don't want to go. For example, I knew from day one I didn't want to go into legal. I understand it. It's good that I saw it, but it's not something I want to do. But I would say a good operator is not necessarily someone who will be good at trading. You know, it's not the same skill set. It's very good that you understand the fundamentals of your business.
Okay.
Usually you're, you know, as you're in contact with all the departments, you see a bit of everything. You understand the whole process within the deal. That's the good part with operations. But again, it's very different skill set. And a lot of operators have the will to become a trader. And unfortunately, you know, there is only limited space, and again, they start the same skill set. Not saying that an operator can never be a trader, but you have to get into mind that this is not the path to become a trader. It is not impossible, but it's not the most common one, I would say.
Okay, very interesting what you say. In our case, in chartering the ship, working,
yeah,
it's better to start in operations because you have a big picture of everything there, switching to trade to ship working.
But would you say this is something to your company only, or is it generally in shipbroking?
Because in shipbroking, I would say only in chartering. If I want to work in a sales purchase, a new building,
yeah,
it's more about having technical skills before, background of it as an engineer architect. But in chartering,
yeah,
if you're on this commercial side, but this kind of, you know, a little bit technical side, operations give you this, you know, this expense. So, but in your case, it's interesting that you can. It's more like you have a bigger gap between both.
Again, I think that's why it depends on companies. I'll take a very big one, for example, Trafigura, you know. as an operator, your job is very vertical. You will stay within ops, and usually they even have different types of ops. You know, you have more legal ops, financial ops, trading ops. It's very different. You know, it's very vertical, whereas where I started, it was very horizontal, meaning that I really had contact with all the departments. And I, exactly, my day was running, you know, to everywhere, going to the legal, going to the finance guys, going to the CFO, going to the head of trade. So in that sense, I would say it was very useful to see and get the bigger picture.
Okay. And now I want to ask you a question to give a big picture to everyone.
Yeah.
Can you describe the full process of a deal? From the having a phrase to sending the phrase, negotiation, everything.
So there's a few ways of going towards it, but I'll describe the most common one. You know, first and foremost, you have to understand the market and see, do you want to go long or short, or you want to do like a back-to-back deal? Some are possible in back-to-back, you know, very big deals. If you can secure, for example, if you're exclusive or you have very good rates with the supplier and you understand their full process. So first and foremost is understand, okay, the selling market, what's the price is going, my purchase market, what's the price is going on, and what's the freight. So usually I'll get those info first through my reports. I always have in mind where the prices are a little bit. Then I try to scatter the market, call everyone I know, you know, and understand a little bit, is the pricing relevant towards the reports? Once I have a little bit of prices, you know, I go to my brokers. Yeah. I check in terms of freight, you know, is this even possible? I check with my supplier, like, okay, look, what's the best price we can do on this? Usually in my way of working, I'm very transparent. You know, when I speak with my suppliers, I'll say, okay, I'm trying to sell at this price. My freight is at this. I'm trying to make this margin. I know it's very controversial, but that's how I work. I like to be transparent. I think that, you know, a good deal is the one where everyone makes money. So once I have all this together, you know, I'll check as well with my compliance department. Can we even make this deal? I check with my finance guys, you know, do we have enough financing available for this? Can we even make it? Once I'm good with all this, usually, you know, it's the global head of trade who will then get the final, yes, you can go on. So then usually I send a firm inquiry, you know, to my seller, to my buyer. It's not necessarily in this order, but, you know, firm offers, I secure my offers, I secure my freight, then I'll send the contracts, we get it financed, and then, you know, you're supervising the deal until, if you're selling CFR, you know, until it arrives at this port, and you will endorse the documents to the final, you know, user of the goods, and that's the end of it. I make sure the final step is when we get paid.
Okay, the very interesting, what do you need to negotiate? The lump sum in freight, the cost of sending the goods?
Everything. So the freight, obviously, this will be more, in my company, at least we have a chartering department, so they will take care, you know. Okay. I'm just looking, look, the market is like this, so when I'll call my ship, my brokers, I'll say, okay, look, I'm looking for a freight at this price. Can you secure it? Do you think it's even doable right now? You know, sometimes it's not. Sometimes I call them and they will say, look, even though reports mention this, as per now, we have vessels, you know, and or ship owners that will do it five above the market because there is no availability. So maybe in that point, you know, I'll not make the deal because that's the negotiation part. You know, a trader, the best deal he can do it is if it's for free, you know. So we always try to negotiate at the lowest. But yeah, everything is negotiable, you know, with your end user. You will see, you know, okay, what's he willing to pay? What can we give him? Obviously, we'll try to drive the price a bit up.
Okay.
That's where you make money. That's just how it is. You know, you try to buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
So that's how you do it. And then you, again, with the suppliers, we're trying to push the price a bit down. So that's why you have to be very understanding of the market. If you go see a supplier and you're only based on one report, maybe you're not going to get you will not get the best price. If you go see your supplier and you know that he secured a deal yesterday, one of your competitors, you know, and it was under market price, you can negotiate on this. Like, I know you did this deal with this guy.
So why not me having the same returns? Okay.
Exactly.
What about the remuneration? Is it based on the trade's value on the... Oh, it was.
So you mean as a trader or as a
trader? As a commodity trader.
So it depends on the companies. Most of the guys will be paid like this. You have a base income, and then usually have a bonus. That's where everything comes in play. So that's very different from company. Companies, some are just saying, you know, end of year, we'll have a discussion and we'll give you a bonus. Just 100% discretionary, you know, just going with it, which is not the best. Maybe when you're a junior, it's a good way of doing it because you don't really know where your metrics are. When you're more experienced as a trader, you'll negotiate. I'll take a raw example that is not representative of anything. But maybe you say, you know, the first million in P&L is only for the company. And above 1 million, we do 50-50 the split in profit. You know, that's a way of doing it, for example. But that's just a raw example. Some is on quantity, you know, some is on, it depends. It depends where they put it. But the most common one that I've seen, at least in my commodity, is, okay, after this amount of profit, we share the profits.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And I talked with someone a few days ago. He told me, community has shared your idea of responsibility. If you make a mistake, it has a big impact on the money behind.
Yeah.
But it's the reason why you can become very wealthy as a trader, yeah, because you touch to huge dividends.
Yeah. So this is a bit a myth. There is a lot of money in commodity trading. I have to agree. People wouldn't be in this industry and wouldn't be idolized as it is if it wasn't. There is some guys making, you know, well above six figures, for sure. You have to understand that most guys are well paid for Swiss or US or Dubai standards or Singapore. But, you know, it's not as much as it is, as you think it is. It's still pretty good, you know, it's decent money. You're earning well, it's a good career. However, it's a lot of responsibilities. That's exactly what you're saying. Sometimes, you know, it's stupid, but you're handling amounts, you know, that are above and beyond what's reasonable for a normal human being. You know, I'm 38 and, you know, I'm starting in life and I'm on the phone speaking about hundreds of millions. I mean, I'm not from this kind of money, you know, and it's weird because it becomes, you know, a normality in your day to day, which is not, man. It's not normal at 30, you know, to be handling almost, you know, numbers and billions in the end of the year. This is not a normal figure to handle, you know? So it's very weird. It is a lot of money involved in this industry. Obviously, you know, you're supplying the global demand in the world for your commodity. So it's normal. But I would say there's still a lot of money, but the responsibility side, you know, is way and beyond the money in the beginning.
Okay.
So when you start, we all always hear about the big time traders, you know, obviously they're making a lot of money, but to arrive there, you know,
the exception.
There is a, you know, usually it's the brilliant guys. I must say guys that are good in trading are genuinely brilliant, really. I do believe so. And, you know, people don't understand how much concessions they have done in life, how much they put, you know, aside, maybe privately, you know, whether it's relationship, friends, time, you know. A lot of guys that I meet that have a lot of experience that are very good. You know, usually it's, yeah, I couldn't train when I was younger or take care of my health because I didn't have time. I never had good relationships privately because nobody can handle, you know, being with someone who wakes up five times a night to take a call.
Okay.
You know, I mean, this is things that you have to understand when you get into the industry. It's not always like this, but there will be nights where you don't sleep. There will be weeks when you just travel and you don't see home. There will be times where you don't even have time to eat, or you never come home. You can never plan your days. So this is things, you know, that, you know.
I get so used to this. I mean, what you say, it's, I mean, in our industry,
yeah,
it's normal. I mean,
it is.
You want to become successful. I mean, if you just want to be average, you can manage a balanced life. But if you want to be successful, I think you need to sacrifice a lot of times.
Yeah.
And love what you do and works for it.
Yeah. So to be honest, this is only a personal opinion. I don't think there's a lot of people that love trading. I think that a lot of people love the result, you know, a little bit like entrepreneurs.
Okay.
Not everybody is passionate about the company they will, you know, create and grow. They're passionate about the numbers, the metrics, you know.
Really?
I don't know, guys who will start a company, whatever, maybe it's not their passion, but, you know, they're passionate about the result.
It's a good way to say it's interesting, huh? Few days do something I'm good at on the or do something I love. For example, I love shipping, but I know that with shipping, if I'm good at enough shipping, I can have a good life.
Yeah.
So combining both is good, you know.
Yeah.
But in your case, it's maybe you like what the task you are doing, the talking to people.
Exactly. So I'm, again, there is people, I know some people that are passionate about fertilizers. I'm not. I will say it straight out. My passion is not fertilizer. It's not, you know, what I do in my free time. But I'm really passionate about my job. I really love what I do. You know, it's amazing to be always in movement. You know, you travel, you see people, you speak to people from all over the world. You get a bigger picture about how economy on a bigger scale works. And this is amazing, you know.
Well, you feel important in the society because what you're doing, it's being... I mean, yes and no. I will say without the shredder, the world would be maybe more expensive if the commodities...
It would be. For sure it would be. I mean, that's not even... Again, it's a claim I will have. I don't say that people need to share it, but again, for sure, if there wasn't traders, our life would be way more expensive. People think it the other way around. If, you know, there was no trader speculating, prices would go down, but that's not how it works, unfortunately. The demand would be the same. Again, the demand is driven by the end consumers. The end consumers are here, whether you like it or not. It's not the traders that are driving the demand. You know, we are playing on supply and demand. That's our job. That's how we make money. But in the end of the day, you know, the demand is here. And as you said, life would be way more different. So yes, you contribute in a certain way to this. There is more of, you know, some people that are a bit more, you know, on the controversial side that, you know, trading is a bit sketchy as well. And, you know, trading, if you've read The World of Sales.
Yes, I have the book.
So you know what I'm talking about. It's been driving wars or contributing or not. Now what's happening in Russia, for sure, you know, there is traders contributing to the war and making Russia richer. But this would happen whether traders are there or not.
Okay. Very interesting what you say. I have many questions regarding the process. I mean, the process is interesting.
Yeah.
But what kind of knowledge except the markets you need to have, I mean, relationship.
Yeah. I think in today's day and age, relationship is still important, but not as much as before. If you discuss with the traders from the 80s and 90s, you know, these are guys that spoke, I don't know, 6-7 languages, you know. Back in the days, you know, you have to understand, you had to move to the country, you know, see people, even understand the culture. You know, there was no emails, there was phones, but you know, in the end of the day, you went to see your supplier, you went to go see your customers. It was way slower business. And these guys are really the bosses of the bosses, you know, of understanding relationship. Today, it's less a people market, you know, it's more driven by price. So,
information.
Yeah, you still have to be good in relationship. Again, you're seeing people all the time. And in the end of the day, you know, sometimes, you know, a deal is not going to be played at $1. That could be handled by relationship. If you're $10 apart, yes, then it's price. You know, it doesn't matter if the guy likes you or not, you know, doesn't really matter at the end of the day, but...
Okay, I understand. Okay, very interesting. I want to ask you another question about the places in the world for commodities trading. We are in Geneva right now. You are from Switzerland. What about the worldwide markets? Is it the best spot to be, I mean, Geneva, or you have other cities you mentioned, like for when you talk.
Yeah. So I would say like this, Geneva historically was one of the best places, not because Geneva is exceptional, just because, you know, we were neutral. We had banks that were not really looking where the money came from back in the days. And, you know, we had high, you know, service driven people skills, generally speaking. And we were specialized into financing and then later on into commodity trading. You know, we have even specialized studies at the uni just solely for this industry, which is pretty rare. So that's why Geneva was a hub, you know, all this microcosm of, you know, safe country, low taxes, neutral, making business with everyone, you know, made this, you know, perfect spot. But in the other hand, you have London as well, which is historically very good. In my commodity, you have NOLA and Tampa in the US. You have Singapore right now. They're starting to take a lot of importance. And now the newcomer is Dubai. And I believe that Dubai is the new Geneva. You know, they have exactly the same type of, you know, situation. Very safe, very low taxes, very keen to getting new businesses. Technically, they are neutral. You can make business with whatever country in the world.
Yeah, geographic spot.
Very easy to get financed. Not as good as in Switzerland. Very interesting geographically, even though it's not as important as before. You still travel, but not as much, but it's still important. And, you know, now I see a lot of skills that are going, because Switzerland is important because there's a lot of highly skilled labor, which is rare. That's what, you know, all the big companies, A, B, C, D, L, they're all looking for this. You know, if you've been applying to jobs, you see the skills that are required. Usually it's a lot of experience, a lot of understanding of the market. So that's why Geneva is so specific to this.
I don't know how to attract people. I mean, in Europe, it's a very nice country to start a career.
I would say if you start off in Geneva, you know, and you get a good job, later on, you can move to Dubai easily. It's hard to go as a junior to Dubai, I would say. Even though they're still recruiting a little bit, you know, juniors, but I would say generally speaking, Dubai is probably part of the future. I cannot read the future. I'm not a magician, but I would say Dubai and Singapore are the ones, you know, battling. It's a bit the same. Both are very similar, you know, good weather all year round. It's very safe. It's pretty low on taxes. You can do business with pretty much everyone. Okay, so.
What do you think about the future of Oman? It's a very big topic on the table, right?
So, again, I will be very skeptical on this because maybe you saw my profile back in days. I used to do politics. So I did politics for about 5 years. My whole point was trying to change the situation instead of complaining.
Yeah.
So I'm still complaining and didn't change much. But but I would say Europe, generally speaking, we're on a downward spiral. Like, we're seeing it everywhere. You know, the metrics are not lying. Like, unemployment rates are getting higher everywhere. Countries are becoming very unsafe compared to before, including Switzerland. It's not unsafe, but it's not as safe as before.
It's not deep cooling, I mean.
Exactly.
Maybe worse, I would say.
Exactly. And, you know, all these metrics are showing that right now, you know, even though we're still having some figures that are positive, like real estate is going up everywhere in Europe.
Stable market.
Exactly. Still very high skill, highly skilled labor. But like we were speaking off camera before, you know, most of people today, if you're young and then you're starting off, I'll take for Switzerland, but if you earn, I don't know, 10,000 USD today, it's not exactly the same as 10 years ago. I see, like, in my parents' time that grew up here, you know, in their time, most of people could buy real estate, you know, and having a good life. They were not necessarily in the very luxury, you know, but they were having a good middle-class life with good jobs, you know, traveling, having a good car, you know, being able to save a bit of money, maybe buy real estate, you know, which is less and less the case today. Not saying that you don't have people earning money, but, you know, real estate is more expensive, cost of living is more expensive, insurances are more expensive, cars are like out of hand in terms of pricing.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm 30, 35 years old, yeah, even less or more. Having no real estate, having no,
yeah,
this is no more.
Really. Yeah, I mean, most of my friends, even in trading, you know, I have people earning like a pretty decent salary in terms of living, if you take in comparison of all over the world. Like, and it's not like they're having a very super hyped up luxury life like you would expect compared to their salary. You know, people would say, they must have luxury cars, they must only travel in first class, and that's just not the case, you know. After the tax authorities comes through, you know, and all this, there's not as much as you would expect left. Not saying that they're in a bad situation, but it's absolutely not a good one. That's why I think Dubai and Singapore are so popular right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the tax side, and, you know, it's not cheap to live in Dubai.
No, but...
But it's not as expensive if you take the major cities in Europe. London, Paris...
Mm-hmm.
Then Geneva and Zurich is just expensive, but it's not major. But
in salary are following there. Yeah. London is the big example of very high living standard, but very low salary. If you start in London, good luck.
Yeah, but London is different because I think they have the highest concentration of millionaires in the world. So there is a lot of big money in London.
Yeah,
that's just saying, like, the salaries are very low. I'm seeing, like, the guys... Most of the insurance brokers are in the UK and you are trading. I am seeing the guys are saying, like, our base salary in the UK is like £2,000, £3,000, but our cost of living is like Geneva or New York standards.
Yeah.
Which is crazy when you see the actual salary they're getting.
Yeah.
And the guys are traveling 2 hours in the morning to get to a job, 2 hours in the evening.
Yeah. No, that's nice what you say. The money is there. We have the very skilled people on very nice university.
Yeah.
So. Lot of skills, yeah. Let's come back to commodities trade.
Yeah.
Let's talk about specialties.
Yeah.
It's very hard because we have so many commodities.
Yeah.
Actually, fertilizer, we have many of them. But we have steel, we have oil.
Yeah.
We have copper, steel.
Yeah.
I mean, iron ore.
Yeah. So I would say divided like this. You have metals, you have oil-based products, and you have the soft commodities, and then you have the specialized, like fertilizers is a bit of all of them because we have some metals in them.
Yeah.
We're based on gas and we're linked to soft commodities, which is all the agri side, but that's like the major poles. Agri, metals, oils.
Okay.
That's like the first thing where you have to choose.
Let's be broad and then specialize on your commodity. Okay, I'm a commodity trader, or I specialize myself.
Yeah.
What I need to take into consideration? If it's a hot commodities in the future,
yeah.
If I like a commodity, if or it...
I would say first and foremost, if you're good of understanding the commodity. Obviously, I think in the industry, don't always choose which commodity you start in. That's the first point. Usually, you know, when you finish studies or you're getting your first job, you're just praying that whatever company will take you, whatever commodity. It's rare when you say, you know, I want to be in rice and I will not take another job other than rice. Some people are like this, but yes, take into consideration which commodity will be there in the future. Okay, most of them will, but generally speaking, you know, which ones are hot and trending. For example, now the guys that were in SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, you know, 10 years ago, these guys were nothing. And today, you know, people are almost laughing at them, especially the crude oil guys. And now, you know, people are seeing that, you know, biofuels, SAF, starting to get super, super popular. And it's only going to be more in the future. And the guys that were here in the beginning are going to be the very big guys later on.
Yeah.
So, but I think if you like it, if you have an understanding in that market, and if you, you know, being good at a commodity is very hard because unless you have an engineering background, you know, I have some guys in my company, they are engineers who used to be head of production, you know, in fertilizers.
Okay.
So these guys are naturally good on that commodity on the very technical side.
You can always learn by yourself.
Yeah. But if you have this kind of strengths, you know,
yeah.
I don't know, if you're a biochemist specialized in oil blends, for example, it's logical that you go into that commodity.
Yeah.
But unless you have this background, take the commodity you like. You know, if you're interested in the oil world, those countries, that those markets, and as well, every single commodity works very differently. You know, the rice traders will not trade the same way as a crude oil trader.
Okay.
We have the same job, but...
Okay, let's talk. I don't know if you know because you're not the... I mean, you're specialized yourself, but let's take each type of commodities and say what are the particularities, if you know, of course. Crude oil, for example. What are the particularities of crude oil trader?
I would say, this is only from my understanding, crude oil, there's a lot of players, a lot of big money,
yeah.
And a lot of big transactions. So it's very, you know, these are the guys where you see they're trading all day, every day, 24/7. It's a quick market. It goes around, like every single minute you have micro changes, you know, and these guys take positions on super high amounts. You know, it's not unseen seeing people taking a position on 1 million tons of crude, 2 million tons of crude. This is like amounts that are enormous, you know, compared to others. So I would say this is driven by very big quantities, you know, and it's a market that is very quick. This is just how I see it, but, you know, it's a different way of trading.
Okay, if you want to go for only for the big money,
yeah,
not talking about the experience and the connections, crude oil is the way to go.
No, freight. I would say nowadays, the freight traders are the guys who make money right now. Okay. Really, you know, it's so important nowadays where you have such a volatility on freight, and you're seeing probably it every day. But, you know, these are the guys that I see that 10 years ago, they were pretty all right in terms of traders. And now these are guys that are starting to make very good money.
Yeah, all trader, what is this?
So these are the guys that will just secure prices on freight, you know?
Oh, on freight, no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. There is some that are specialized, some not, but these are guys making money. Obviously, the crude oil guys, very limited in terms of space. There's not that many places, like spots available to become an oil trader, and it's very hard. That's why I think, you know, the ticket that you're paying to enter and, you know, the sacrifice you're making, that's why you're making money. Oil will always be a lot of money. It's a very high value industry. The closer you are to the money, the more you earn. So obviously you're close to the very big money.
Okay.
And I would say, you know, it's the biggest, you know, market in the world, all in all, like
the biggest commodity.
Yeah. Well, the biggest product in the world, generally speaking, it is the most valuable thing in the world. That's why you have countries that are built solely on this.
Yeah. All about oil, it's a collapse thing. I mean, everything.
For now, we cannot live without oil.
We're all based on everything.
Thing based on oil, everything.
Yeah. Even, you know, artificial intelligence is driven by oil, because oil is producing energy. Yeah. And this energy is used, you know, for the power for AI. So even, you know, something that is so far away from oil is, technically speaking, oil based.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, now the steel markets. What are the particularities of steel traders? Cooper.
Yeah, so they have a very different job. So first and foremost, I see, you know, there is guys that have understanding of how the commodity, you know, is brought up. A lot of business developers in this industry. In the steel markets, you have a lot of people, you know, going to the countries where you have the different type of metals and going, you know, to find it. It's, you know, that's why they have a lot of traders that are involved in mining, etc. So this is more on the physical side. And, you know, it's, you have a commodity that is a bit more perishable. You know, it's a bit different on that side. I don't have that much knowledge because I haven't been at all in the metals. So this is just things I can see.
But you see, it's a very interesting market. Can you project yourself in this market, be very good at this with this market?
So I would say every single market, it has a projection on the long term. I mean, I don't think at our age there is any market, apart from a very few, of course, but there's not a single market that will not exist in 20 years when we retire. So every single market has a future. They're just very different. You know, weather is going to be as hot as today. You know, crude, maybe in 30 years, will not be as hot as, you know, biofuels at that point, or hydrogen or whatever, you know.
Okay, interesting. And we have the food traders as well.
Yeah.
Pea, rice,
exactly.
Cacao.
So yeah, all the agri guys. So this is an industry, you know, that is a bit differently driven because it's into a sensible and very sensitive subject, which is feeding people, you know. So there is another view to it because, you know, there is almost, you know, a humanitarian, you know, vision to it. But it's a very big market, you know. For example, the banana traders, people don't think about it, but the biggest is Chiquita, you know. They're like the biggest traders. These guys have like, they own the market of bananas in the world. Like, people don't realize it. And there is a few banana traders, but generally speaking, this commodity, you know, you specialize in one thing, and it's a bit more stable than others. Because I would say, like, for example, the rice traders, you need rice all year round. Doesn't matter. Like, most of Asian African countries are literally depending on rice. That's like their main source of eating, you know. So it's a bit more stable. These guys have such a knowledge, like the coffee traders, the rice traders, into every single speciality within their, you know, commodity, whether it's long grain rice, short grain, this type, how it grows. So these are almost guys that have a farming background, you know. But generally speaking, I would say it's very, it's so different in the soft commodities, you know, from a cacao trader would absolutely not have the same job as a rice trader.
Of course.
Even though it's the same type of companies, but again, this is kind of big volumes as well. Not always, but it's not as volatile. This is more, you know, some of the guys have very long-term trading contracts with countries, for example, or... So as it's feeding people, you know, it's a bit different. Less volatility, but as many responsibilities, I would say.
Yeah, of course. And what about your specialty, fertilizer?
Can you
explain it with you?
So this is like the hidden market. It's super niche. I would say, first and foremost, having an understanding of how fertilizer works, like which fertilizer is used in what way, how is it,
Where do we have...
So I'm just going to go with the main ones. You know, you have urea is the number one most traded fertilizer. Then you have the rock phosphate. You have the TSP, SSP, DAP, MOP. And this is like the main ones. There is so many others. And then you have the super specialized fertilizers, the blends, you have some guys that specialize into modifying, you know.
Okay.
And you know, producing from urea, then doing specialized, then you have the liquid side. That one I don't really do, but okay. It's more, you know, an understanding of how the fertilizers are used, how are they produced, where are they used, what timing, etc.
Okay. And what about the trading aspect of fertilizer? The market is the fast evolving market.
So as I said, there is no indexing on the prices. Yeah. You know, we don't have anything to understand apart from our reports and rumors of what's the prices. So generally speaking, it is pretty volatile compared to before. Before it used to be a market, you know, you could almost trade on historical highs and historical lows. You know, you were just comparing year from year, one price were going up and down, and it was pretty stable. Since COVID, you know, we saw prices that we'd never seen before in our commodities. For example, urea, which is the main one, FOB prices vary, you know, historically was maybe from 200 to 400. That was like the normal range within a year, depending on season and demand, etc. And during COVID, we saw prices almost to the thousands and some above thousands, which is crazy when you see, you know, commodities going from like 300 to 1,000. So, but that's just generally speaking during COVID. So now I'd say prices evolve pretty quickly. It's not on the hour basis, but it's on the daily basis, you know.
What types of countries are producing fertilizer? What are the biggest, exporter? On the...
I would say, so one of the biggest producers, generally speaking, would be Russia. You have a lot of China as well. India is a very big producer, but they only produce for the domestic market. China is a bit the same, mostly used on domestic market. They are a big driver, you know, whether they export or not during the year. You have all the Middle Eastern countries, because where you have the phosphate is where you can produce it. So either you have phosphates, for example, Middle East and Northern Africa is where you have most phosphates in the world. If you have gas, you know, urea is based on gas. That's why Russia are a big producer of urea. And then you have other countries, you know, that are producing like the US, etc. But, you know, I would say Middle East, Asia is about the biggest producers. And Russia, obviously, but...
Okay, interesting. And do you need to... How it works about communication? You need to travel, to this...
So, approach. I think I came into the wrong timing, you know. When I evolved here, I wanted to become a trader for the traveling side as well. Because I just love to understand culture, see people. With COVID, I think there's less traveling. People still go to conferences and meet their very big customers, but way less than before. People are more keen, you know, to do a Zoom call, or that's why I said in the beginning, I'm spending my day on my phone on WhatsApp or WeChat or Telegram, whatever, just because, you know, people are not traveling as much as before. So you're still in contact with people from all over the world just through phone. Then for me, it's a bit different because we have, you know, an office in China, we have in Singapore, we have in Dubai, in Vietnam, Malaysia, in India. So the moment I need something for those countries, I get in contact with my guy in the office.
Okay.
But there's still, I would say, like a trader travels about 50 to 100 days a year. If you have a more senior position, maybe you would travel 150 days a year.
It's going to be.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays that's only the very big. I mean, for example, if you take, from what I see, like most of the head of trades, you know, they go to different offices, they see, you know, that everything is going well, they are the ones securing with the suppliers, they see the very big customers, they have to be at every single conference. Whereas if you're only a trader, you know, you're going to go to your market. For example, I rarely go to the conference in Asia because we have an office in Asia, that guy handles the Asian market. I go mostly once in Europe, you know, or North Africa, or Eurasian.
It does. Very interesting. Okay, yeah. Do you want to add something about fertilizer?
I don't really have anything to say about fertilizer because, again, it's a very opaque market. The only thing is that I think why I think it's interesting is we're doing really it in an old-fashioned way. We, you know, we don't hedge ourselves. It is basically you do a deal and you hope it's going well, and you know.
How do you benchmark the markets? So if there is no indice, I mean, you.
So do you have reports? You know a little bit, you know, from calling.
Yeah. And go.
You have your, you know, I have my brokers, I have my buyers, I have my suppliers, I have fellow traders, you know. because some from time to time we work together, so we know a bit the market how it is. The reports are very useful, but generally speaking, just from buying and selling, you understand if you have, I don't know, you have FOB at 350, you have a freight on 20, you know, you need about $1 or $2 to finance and just to secure yourself with demurrage, etc. So you know that at that point, you know, below 372, there is no market on spot basis.
Okay.
So on that point of time, you just understand that just, you know, CFR market will be 373 and above.
Okay.
Understanding. And the type of, I mean, the transportation by sea, this is...
So for me, it's bulkers. Most of the
bulkers, yes. You
say. I don't do much liquids. I do it sometimes, but for myself, usually, if it's, as I'm in Europe, it's a lot of small quantities, smaller ports. So I usually go for bulkers with cranes on the ship because most of the ports, you know, cannot discharge, you know, on bulk. They don't have enough good cranes, whatever. So that's the only very specific thing for me, you know. If you speak to the big traders, when I tell them that I do deals, you know, for 1,000 metric tons, 1,500, they almost choke to my face. You know, it's very small quantities in this industry. So that's one specialty. You know, we are, if you ask the guys from the finance side, they would say that fertilizers is very high margins, you know. In crude oil, sometimes, you know, your margins are below $1, you know, because the quantities are huge.
Yes.
For us, it's not unseen to have traders making $30, $40, $50 on the ton.
Is on margin. Expensive commodity.
It depends. So you have, you know, urea right now is, I would say, very largely between 350 and 400, depending where you buy and what's the quantities, you know. But then you have others like DAP. They will be more now in the 600s, you know. So it all depends on which commodity. So it depends if you define, is that expensive or not per ton. But for sure, it's less expensive than other commodities. You know, the cheapest for us is the rock phosphate, a very raw one. You know, that's historically sub-100.
And the most expensive?
Most expensive, I would say it's very, very specialized water-soluble fertilizers that are, you know, specifically with micronutrients for one type of crop. You can go $2,000 and above per ton.
Okay. How many types of fertilizer do you have different?
It depends what you say. So if it's straight fertilizers, you know, the very major ones, I would say there is about 15 to 20, but the moment you get specialized, you know, the one with micronutrients, you know, it's almost endless. You can have one type of fertilizer. So the specialized is called MPKs. So, you know, you have a certain percentage of N, of P, of K. And then you can add micronutrients, you know, iron, zinc, boron, magnesium, manganese. This endless. So you can have, you know, you can fiddle it however you want. So it's...
Okay, quite clear. Tobias, I want to ask you a last question.
Tommy.
So what type of tips and advices can you give to young people who want to start working as a commodities trader?
I think only personal opinion, but you need to understand the chartering side. It's very important. I think there is not a single company that will not ask you to be good at this. This is always a strong point. If you can start in chartering, that would be a very big plus. Obviously, if you have the masters in commodity trading, it can only help.
Yeah.
I don't believe that having a strong background in studies is very important, because I didn't study to become a trader. I became a trader because of I learned it the hard way. I would say that, you know, you need to be able, even if it's a bit cliche, don't count your hours. Yeah. You will start in the industry, you know, operations is not something that pays very well. So in the beginning, you're not in it for the money. And you have to understand that it's a very few spots available. And, you know, you will have to be better at something than someone. You have very different types of traders, you know. Some, as I said, would be very good on relationships. Some would be very good, you know, on the technical side. The guys are, maybe he has an engineering background, you know, and understands the commodity like no one before. So I would say first, chartering. If you have a bit of experience in, you know, the commodity you want to. So if you want to go into iron ore, make sure, you know, you only target companies within iron ore. You know, maybe do a little bit of ops, maybe do chartering. If you can, you know, scatter around, be a little bit everywhere. If you can enter a graduate program, that is very well as well. That's the good ones. in today's day and age, if you're going into crude, you know, it's never bad to be good at coding, you know, Python, SQL is something very important today. We're moving into a different era. So if you're very good at analyzing, you know, that's good. If you have this kind of background, so maybe starting as an analyst in the company, you know, or as an assistant trader, that would be the absolute most. And you need to speak English.
Yeah,
I mean, the more languages you have, the better. I would say if you speak Arabic, Mandarin, or Russian, that would be a very good start. That is, if you have those languages plus English, that's very good.
Yeah, because now having English plus your native language is, I mean, standard, yeah. And everyone must speak English.
Yeah,
especially in our industry, which is a mess, of course.
Yeah, I mean, as you see in Geneva, there is no one, they're never even asking for French. They're asking you for English. I mean, they don't even ask for it. I mean, it is English.
English, that's it, yeah.
She speaks French, yeah.
Very. With French colleagues, you just speak English and then it is why you speak.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you, Tobias.
Thank you as well, man.
Pleasure to have you.
Likewise.
Even myself, I learned a lot of stuff today.
I learned a lot.
Imagine the audience, so thank you.
I'm happy if I can share.
And I wish you all the best.
Thank you for listening and watching this episode. We are looking forward to bring you more insights from maritime professionals, experts, and students. Do not hesitate to follow the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Your support means a lot to us and helps us to bring you more content.